Welcome, everyone, to this special edition of Narsil in Action. Tonight's episode is the first Narsil in Action we've done since March of 2020. Are you going to fade the music? There you go. Due to the pandemic and other distractions, we haven't had a conference call for quite some time. And it's really gratifying that we have well over 150. Actually, it's closer to 200. Finding the time to put these programs together is always a challenge, especially since I now co-host the Registry Matters podcast, which is a weekly production. Andy, my lovely co-host of Registry Matters, is assisting with production this evening and is responsible for making everything run smoothly. So if you have a problem tonight, remember andy@registrymatters.com. Just kidding. We have planned to award an prize during the call at some point. I think it'll be in the second hour. It'll be a registration to attend the upcoming conference in Houston, which most people have already paid for. But if not, you can apply it to 2022, which we will be announcing that location very soon. And you could also gift it to someone else if you've already paid. So if you would like to enter that drawing, text CONTEST at 747-227-4477. We will confirm that you've been entered and you will receive a contestant number from Andy. And as I said earlier, it can be transferred if you've already paid, or you can use it for 2022. And those of you who didn't sign up, and there are always some, if you do sign up now, you can still sign up as long as the program is active. And we will be sending out, hopefully, some conclusions and some follow-up stuff in the form of an email, so you'll get the email like you've been getting emails today. I think everyone got two emails today from us. And I'll ask you for your indulgence for just a few moments while I make some housekeeping announcements. The program will have a 5-minute break at the top of the hour for folks to do whatever they need to do. And then we will resume and you will hear the same new sounder that we played just now at the beginning of the second hour. And if you've attended one of these calls in the past, you know that I love to keep the program moving along. This means that when we go to audience questions, I would really like a question and not a story. And if you start telling a story, I'm going to really try to shut the story down and say, please get to your question. So that's just the way you keep the program moving. If we actually need more detail, we'll actually come back to you and ask. But once the question has been asked, the caller, whoever it is, will be muted because I don't like overtalk and I don't like background noise. And so if you ask a question, the answer is going to be heard. So we will unmute you if we need additional information. And we are certainly planning to have questions in the second hour, and it is even possible we might take some in the first hour. It depends on how fast we get through these intros and the prepared questions. So the master schedule that you've received, and most people have, but for the first hour, we're going to be talking about the Scarlet Legal Action Project. The second hour, we're going to be promoting our upcoming conference, and we're going to be taking audience questions. So for the first hour, we're going to have two guests. We're going to have Paul Dubling, and we're going to have Narsil's Executive Director, Brenda Jones. So I'm going to start by doing bio on Paul. For those of you who do not know Mr. Dubling, he's a former U.S. Army Ranger and infantry officer. He attended law school on an Army scholarship and graduated, and I never can pronounce that, so I'm going to not, but anyway, from Indiana University in Bloomington in 2005, and then he served as JAG attorney for 6 years, including 2 tours in Afghanistan. After leaving the Army, Mr. Dubling clerked for Neil Gorsuch, who is now an Associate Justice on the United States Supreme Court, before earning his MBA degree from Duke's Fuqua School of Business and going into private law practice. Since then, he successfully prosecuted Doe's versus Cooper, a federal lawsuit which struck down much of North Carolina's previous premises restrictions, and is currently lead counsel for Narsil's legal challenge to North Carolina's registration, and that case is Doe's versus Stein. Mr. Dubling now serves as Narsil's attorney and general counsel. And Brenda Jones, I could go on and on, but she's the executive director of Narsil, the executive director of Families Advocating for Intelligent Registries. She wears many hats for Narsil and bails us all out of our failures and is the gentle nudge that keeps things moving. Families Advocating Intelligent Registries is the Narsil affiliate in Maryland. So welcome to both of you, and thank you for your time tonight. Paul, are you hearing me okay?
Yes, I can hear you just fine.
Okay. Brenda, are you unmuted?
I believe so. Are you hearing me all right?
Well, it's faded a little bit from when we got it corrected earlier, but I can still hear you. So Better. So we're gonna try to get into these questions because I know people have questions for both of you, and you're both very popular. So all these people that signed up didn't come for me. I'm quite certain. So Brenda, you've been involved with NARSL for many years. In fact, I think I met you back in 2010 in person when I traveled to Maryland. Just a little brief story. How did you become an advocacy? Because everybody wants to know a little bit about what inspired you.
Well, I'll give you a little bit more than my elevator speech then, but not too much. I did get started in 2010, and I got started due to having a loved one who had started serving time. And I realized, doing some research after that, just how messed up the laws were regarding sex offenses. And in 2010, they started introducing gobs and gobs of laws in the Maryland legislature. I had absolutely no idea what I was doing, deer caught in the headlights. And Larry, we met because somebody connected us from far away. You were in New Mexico, so you remote controlled me pretty much that year, helping me get through that legislative session with a handful of other folks who were equally new at it. And we did manage to, be a little bit successful that year, I think, in stopping some of the legislation. That's how I got involved, and I frankly just have never really looked back. My loved one finished serving his time. He's out and doing his own thing, but I'm still pretty intimately involved in the advocacy work.
So awesome. Well, folks, those who do not know Brenda, she really does do so much for us, and she keeps so many things moving and has the disposition to keep a family from fighting. So we really appreciate having you around. Paul, I've introduced you with your bio, but I'm sure the audience would be intrigued to find out a little bit about what attracted you to this work, specifically the work you've done for the cause and some of your goals going forward. I'm able to say without any hesitation that it's probably not the money, since there's so little money to be made in this area of the law. So tell us about yourself, Paul. What makes you tick on this work?
Well, the original my original involvement was, quite frankly, pretty much accidental. Some people on this call may have heard of Glenn Girding, who is an attorney here in North Carolina who went on to become our appellate defender. And in 2016, I met Glenn, and he said that he was interested, based on his criminal defense work, in potentially bringing a constitutional challenge to some aspects of North Carolina's registry laws. And Glenn and I got along together, so I volunteered to help him with that. And that ended up becoming Doe v. Cooper, which, a couple of years later, we won at the trial level, and then that was upheld. Our victory was upheld at the Fourth Circuit, and things sort of took off from there. I'm candid in saying that, in 2016, I really had no clue what I was doing, and if there had been anyone else to do it, they probably would have been better qualified. But we sort of muddled our way through, and honestly, the law was so sort of indefensible that we won sort of despite ourselves. And in the process of doing that, I learned a lot more about the registry laws and sort of saw the ways in which I believe that they were pretty straightforwardly unconstitutional. And so I brought another case in North Carolina, and that was also a victory. And, 5, 6 years later, I just find myself in a position where this is an aspect of my practice that is ongoing. And as I've learned more and more about registry laws and the ways in which they can be successfully challenged, it's just something that I've continued to do and has expanded as a part of my practice.
Well, like I said, I know it's not the money, because so many people don't have the resources, and we struggle for that. But it sounds like a passion because of the blatant unconstitutionality. Brenda, we've done cases before at NARSL. We've originated cases from the very beginning, and we provided support. So Narsil's making all this noise about this new program. So tell me what has Narsil done in the past, and how is the Scarlet Legal Action Project going to be different? You know, what are we doing different now?
Well, sure. Well, we began, of course, back at the beginning, just with people contacting us, asking questions or, you know, wanting to know about laws. And then we started assisting financially a little bit here and there as our budget grew. We started out with things like amicus briefs, that, you know, friend of the court briefs, where we could have an impact on a particular case. For example, we were helping out with the Rhode Island residency restrictions challenge with the ACLU. We've also helped financially with a recent case in Ohio with some funds, and we did an amicus there, and that one involved due process for people that were coming into Ohio. Now, more recently, again, as our budget was able to handle it, we've actually filed some lawsuits on our own. And at that point, we were doing, you know, we had some pretty strict criteria, especially we need to make sure that it's a case that has a broader impact than just one person. And there should be a reasonable chance of winning the case because, again, we don't have money to throw at something that's not going to win, right? So, for example, another couple of examples would be we filed two challenges in Georgia against police overreach, where they were putting signs in the yards on Halloween. And Paul and Larry, I know, can mention a couple more. You've already mentioned one in North Carolina. But with all of these that we've been working on, we've always had to go find an attorney in the vicinity, get them on board, and then help us out on that particular case. So what's new and exciting here is that with the Scarlet Legal Action Project is that now when there are potential cases, we can start right in with Paul. We'd still need to connect with other attorneys, of course, if they're in a state that's further away, but Paul can be in the driver's seat, and that's going to make things a whole lot easier, we hope.
Well, I keep hearing the term impact litigation. So, Paul, this is your area of expertise. Tell us about what is meant by that term. I know, but the audience may not know. So explain impact litigation.
Well, you know, I think what I see wrong with registry laws in general, I see two things wrong. One, I do believe that it's an example across the board of society's desire to find scapegoats and desire to sort of act without regard to the facts or the reality. So, you know, working on these cases, the common thread I see in registry laws is this sort of singular idea that the world can be divided into good and evil, and that once someone is categorized as evil, you know, anything and everything goes. And I see that happening, and as Brenda mentioned, that's particularly with regard to more and more, maybe I'm just becoming more aware of it, but I've certainly in the last couple of years become more and more aware of this problem of law enforcement overreach, you know, individual sheriffs and law enforcement officers going beyond what the law allows, and certainly what the law requires for registrants, and legislative overreach. You know, legislatures passing laws that they sort of know, I think any reasonable person would see as an overreach. And I think registry laws are based on a mode of thinking that is fundamentally incorrect. You know, the idea that people can be sort of categorized, that the application of rules, regardless of individual circumstance and history, makes sense, is what drives a lot of these rules, but is also just sort of fundamentally wrong. There is no, to my mind, coherent category of sex offender in the sense that creating that category then allows you to do anything meaningful and accurate with it. The fact that someone has committed a sex offense, you know, just doesn't mean a whole lot going forward. So, you know, when you say what is impact litigation, to me, it's litigation that has, you know, broader effects that helps in the what I see is the fight against those tendencies, the tendency to think categorically, the tendency to seek out scapegoats, the tendency to depart from the facts. And where that becomes a concrete sort of concept is that it's litigation that can have broader implications, that can sort of vindicate the idea that sheriffs are not allowed to place restrictions on people that aren't in the law, and vindicates the idea that certain types of restrictions divorced from individual assessments of actual public danger are improper, both as a matter of public policy, as a matter of sort of logical and coherent thinking, and as a matter of constitutional law.
So, well, that was a long way around, but it did get to the point. That's exactly what we're trying to do. When people contact us, they often have a very compelling case, but it's only going to help them if that case is won. And when you're dealing with donor funds, most people are donating for the greater good. And that's kind of what we're trying to do with the Scarlet Legal Action Program, is to engage in more impact litigation. Brenda, I'm gonna throw this back to you. We now have an agreement with Paul. he's on retainer. So can you explain what took so long? I mean, we've been doing litigation and we've been working on this, and so we finally got the project launched. Can you explain to our supporters, well, Marcel is just so bureaucratic. I mean, it takes them to ever do anything. They can't get a news release out. They can't do this, and it's taken us a while to get this launched. So what took so long?
Well, the main thing here, the big obstacle here, has been simply having that sustainable source of funding. That was the big obstacle. Just fairly recently, Robin, who's been doing our fundraising now for several years, was able to go out and secure enough financial commitments, pledges, if you will, for funding that will guarantee that we can afford Paul for at least 5 years. And that is ultimately what gave us that solid footing that we needed to be able to launch.
So it's all about... It's all about it. NARSL sounds like a conservative organization to us. Why can't we just do these things and hope that the funding comes? I mean, that would be, I mean, I've heard of prayer being successful, so we should have just hoped for the best, right? And I'm being a little bit facetious here, but people have been emailing and asking, you know, you've been talking about this for a long time. What are you going to launch? Well, we took our time trying to get the right agreement and trying to get secure, stable funding. And we don't want to have to disengage on something once we started. And we believe we'll be able to see this through for a number of years with the commitments we have. And of course, anything can change, because if we irritate enough people that have made those pledges, they can always withdraw them. But we think we're stable enough to go forward. So that's a good answer. Paul, you've litigated a number of cases already, and you've been part of litigation in states outside of North Carolina. NARSL's goal is, of course, to build a network of cooperating or partner attorneys similar to the ACLU's model. Can you share with the audience some of the work you've done in the past that we believe makes you very well suited for one of these components of your role? Now, his job description is so long that no person alive can do it, but we think he's well suited for this particular part. So tell the people why you're so well suited to help us build our network.
Sure. You know, largely when you're talking about federal constitutional issues, those cut across state lines. And, you know, I think I mentioned earlier, when I first started doing this work in 2016, I was aware that it could be done, but quite frankly, didn't really know how to do it. At this point, though, I haven't counted in a while, but I don't know, 10, a dozen full-on federal lawsuits that I've been the lead counsel on. And I've been fortunate enough to, through this work, meet a number of people in different states, Florida, Connecticut, New Mexico. On Monday, actually, I'm flying down to Alabama to meet an advocate down there as we consider a constitutional challenge to some of Alabama's laws. So, you know, in some sense, that network has already started to be built. Anytime that there's a suit for me outside of North Carolina, I need and I want local counsel. And as my work has grown and as NARSOL's sort of support and reach has grown, I've had the opportunity to build those relationships in a number of different states, and I believe we'll continue to build those relationships going forward. And, you know, basically what I found is, just like anything, practice is what makes you better. You know, my goal in life professionally and as a person is don't make the same mistake twice. And, you know, over the last 6 years, we've been fortunate. You know, we've won a bunch of cases. I don't think, you know, knock on wood, at this moment, we haven't lost any that we should have won. But I've made mistakes in those cases. And each time I've brought a lawsuit, it's been better than the one before, both in terms of its setup, both in terms of its strategy. And I believe that at this point, frankly, I've gotten pretty good at seeing a lawsuit, knowing what we need to do to be successful, and making good calls about what's worth putting money into and what isn't, both in terms of is the lawsuit going to be successful, and in terms of given limited resources, what is going to have the broader impact. At the same time, you know, more and more, there's a fairly limited universe of lawyers in the country that do this kind of work regularly. And if you are one of those lawyers, eventually you tend to sort of know of each other. So, you know, at this moment, I don't look at it as just me. There's, you know, three or four people in the country that I trust very much and that I reach out to when I'm considering a constitutional challenge, when I have questions about, you know, what they think this should look like. It's a group effort. You know, I think I'm fortunate to be in a position where I have the experience and the desire to lead that effort, but I'm certainly not a person who believes that my way is the only way. And I'm certainly, this is an irony that maybe some of our callers have experienced. I know so much about sex offender litigation and sex offender law now that I've become more amazed at what I don't know than I was a year ago when I knew less. The more expertise I get in this, the more I realize there's avenues, there's arguments, there's considerations that are new to me. And so I rely on a network of attorneys and frankly, folks at NARSOL, folks at Mitchell Hamlin University, the people across the country that are invested in this work to help us try to get to the right answer.
So, well, I had this as a question coming next, but I'm just going to make a statement. You know, you'll be representing and assisting us at the National Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys at our exhibit, which will be in November, the late November. I'm not sure the dates. I think it's 17th through 19th, if I recollect. And we have been attending that exhibit for a number of years, and we've had limited success, I guess, because we just really haven't connected well after the fact. And we're going to try to improve that. And one of the reasons why I ask and you agreed to be there is that we really want to build our partner relationships. We want people to know we exist. Few of them have even heard of us. And we're going to this event in November. We'll be there. And actually, Janice, who is the president or executive director of the Alliance for Constitutional Sexual Offense Laws, has exhibited with us 1 year. And Janice went out and chased people and talked to them and was very, very outgoing. I'm a little more introverted than that. But we'll have about 400 attendees is typically what comes, and they're lawyers from both the private sector, the public defender sector, and even the military attorneys are there. And we are hoping to build some relationships in that event. And Paul, we do believe that with your experience of what you've been doing and with your charisma, you can help us with that. And that's what we're looking forward to happening in November. So I just told about what our plans are for the event, but you can feel free to comment as well. So you want to add something
to that event. And I'm looking forward to, you know, seeing what people are up to. Again, I think one thing I've seen is that this litigation has tend to be disjointed, you know, sort of individual challenges done in isolation. And I think there's a growing and a growing awareness that this is, for lack of a better word, a field of law. And, you know, more and more I've started to field calls from, you know, not random people, but, you know, say the ACLU or, you know, local criminal defense attorneys or something. And I enjoy being a resource for that, you know, looking at people's situations, offering whatever advice or input I can give, and conversely learning from them. This is what the judges here are telling us. This is what has worked for me in the past from those people. So I am quite hopeful that we'll have a good opportunity to have those kind of conversations in Las Vegas coming up.
So, Brenda, this is kind of going to be a repetition of what I've asked earlier, but I get this email and I get this all the time about NARSL being too conservative and stuck in a rut, and we just are not bold enough. And I'd like for you just to take a couple of moments to explain a little bit more about what we actually do in legal. You've covered it briefly, but I mean, there's cases that nobody hears about. We've helped in Oklahoma, we've helped in Arizona, we've helped in many states, and why is NARSL so conservative in terms of not politically, but in terms of moving forward? Just be bold, go out there and do it, and it'll work out. That's all it takes. It's just a little bit of vision.
Well, we prefer, if conservative is the word we're using, I assume we're mostly talking about funds. And funding, all of our funding comes from donors. And we take those donations very, very seriously. If you are sending money to us for legal cases, in general or in specific, it's usually in general, but if you're expecting us to go out and fight these registry laws with that money, we want to make sure you are getting maximum bang for the buck. And so we don't just grab the first thing that comes along. We do look very carefully at each case. We were doing it before we launched this SLAP, and we're going to continue to do it after we launched SLAP, Scarlet Legal Action Project. I think we'll be able to even better now do that. And I think we'll be able to move forward more quickly while still being cautious. And I think that's part of what we're so excited about.
So, Paul, this leads me to my next question. NARSL envisions your role in the development of the Scarlet Legal Action Project to be the person who guides and mentors the partner attorneys, because as you stated just a moment ago, there's a small number of people who are good at this. So this means you will be helping us recruit them. And when we partner with them, you'll be reviewing their pleadings, and we will be hoping that you will help them to understand how to best frame their arguments for success. And all this depends on the forum you're litigating in. And just try to, you did it earlier, but folks, we want you to understand that this is a person, Paul, has lots of relevant experience. And so tell us about why you're comfortable in this role and you accepted this request. Because, again, it's not the money. we're only paying him a fraction of what he's worth. But tell us about your experience, what makes you so well-suited for these goals that we have for the Scarlet Legal Action Project.
At this point, I think it's just, if you include the number of cases that I've reviewed, consulted on, you know, not just the ones that I personally have been the lead counsel on or been the architect of, that's getting to be a lot of cases. How do I put this? There are certain things that are good and certain things that are not. And what I find is that a lot of attorneys who become interested in this work, the way that people sort of come into this work as attorneys are, as Brenda mentioned, they have loved ones that get caught up in the criminal justice system and get caught up in the registration system, and that brings them in. The other way is that they're criminal defense attorneys who become aware that beyond the express punishment for the crime, their clients are caught up in this whole other world of these laws that they sort of instinctively know seem wrong. but they don't know and they don't have experience in how to do anything about that, how to articulate what that wrongness is, and even when they've articulated what it is, how to just sort of procedurally and effectively bring that claim, how to pick the plaintiff, how to do this. So on the front end, you know, just through repetition, just through doing as many 1983 actions or being involved in them as I have, I'm well versed in sort of the how do you do this, right? How do you physically bring a claim? What is the, you know, think down to what does the caption have to look like? How do you access the court system and file it? The other thing that is remarkable is the defenses to these claims are remarkably consistent. You know, I can tell you with a high degree of fidelity when you file a claim, what the state's going to do, what they're going to argue. You know, if it's a due process claim or a First Amendment claim or an ex post facto claim, you know, which are the areas that this sort of litigation has been successful. You know, I can tell you what the state's going to do, and I can tell you what the argument is. For instance, when I file a claim in North Carolina, the state is immediately going to claim that since the law is more than 3 years old, the statute of limitations is run and I can't bring them. I know they're going to do this. They're going to do this despite the fact that they have said that in every one of six prior cases. And whatever court I'm in, it has a case that says that's not right. They're going to cite the same case from the Fourth Circuit, arguing that the First Amendment challenge is invalid. They're just going to do the same thing over and over again because the defenses are rote and the defenses are fairly tired, but they're all that the state really has when faced with sort of thing. The other thing that, you know, the state is always going to argue that you sued the wrong person, that you sued the sheriff instead of the district attorney. But if you sue the district attorney, they're going to argue you should have sued the sheriff. And as you do this more and more, and as you respond to these arguments, you just start to know exactly what to do. You know, for instance, in North Carolina, there's this great case where the sheriff and the district attorney got different lawyers, both of whom argued that it was the other person that should have been sued. And the court basically said, no, you both are proper for suit. This is moving forward. So helping people understand sort of procedurally who to sue, how to sue, what claims to make, helping people respond to the stock defenses. And then the other thing that sort of runs through what becomes vitally important in these suits is what's the standard of review. And it's vitally important to set up your cases to try to put the state in a position where it has to do more than just say the court should defer to the legislature. Because as soon as you can make the state start putting on evidence, as soon as you've put them in a position where they can't just say the legislature wrote the law and the court should follow that lead, that's where you're going to win. Because, you know, our first successful case, Doe v. Cooper, the reason we won is the state was incapable of putting on any evidence that persons who had committed a sexual offense against an adult were any ongoing threat to minors. They couldn't put on evidence because they didn't have any. And because we brought that as a First Amendment claim, where the state has to meet a heightened sort of standard of review, we won that case. And I see that consistently. So that, you know, that's some concrete examples, but basically, you know, at the end of the day, it's experience. If you do this work, if you do it consistently, you know, quite honestly, by the 20th time through or so, you start to know what's going to happen. You know what you need to say, you know what they're going to say, you know where the pressure points are. And my hope is that, you know, I can help people new to this understand that. And I remain open. If someone just wants a second opinion, maybe they've thought of something that I haven't. And, you know, if that's true, I'll put that in my bank. And then the next time I'm talking to someone, I'll say, hey, you know, in addition to this, I talked to, you know, so-and-so out of Alabama. I don't think he'll mind my using his name. I talked to Mitch McGuire out of Alabama, and he said, you know, this has worked for him too. And that's, you know, what we're trying to do here is, you know, I have the experience to take the lead on this, but also as you mentioned, Larry, what we're looking to do is know the people who know what we don't know. You know, I think in life, the hardest thing is knowing when you don't know something. It's hard to know what you don't know. And the more we can build relationships, the more I can simply ask people that I trust, hey, this is what I know. And I know a lot, but in knowing a lot, I've come to realize that there's a lot that I don't know. So what is that? right? What don't I know? How can we get better at this across the board?
Well, Andy has a button for things that we don't know. And so we're getting an echo, Andy. But yeah, that button, if you get make it play, I'd like to hear it. So I don't really have any more questions, and we're going to be able to get to the phone lines a little sooner than I expected. So what we have to do here, folks, is we have to make a transition from lecture mode to caller mode, which means I have to switch and then I have to find our guest again, which shouldn't take but a couple seconds, but I'm going to switch it to Q&A. And I do believe they haven't changed it. So as soon as I make that switch, if you have a question, then you'll go to *6. So let me see if I can make the switch. And worst that can happen is fail. So now we've got Brenda's microphone open, and now we've got Paul's microphone back open. So *6 will put you into the queue, and you can ask a question to Mr. Dubling or to Brenda, to Ms. Jones. And please be specific on who you're directing the question to. If you have a question for Paul, say for Paul. If you have a question for Brenda, say for Brenda. And try to keep the story to a minimum, because I'm going to rush you along and say, please get to a question if you go too far. So there are already people jumping in here, and I'm going to try to get this person. It's been a year and a half, folks, so I've got to make sure I know what I'm doing. So I believe this person here. Judith, you are on Narsil in Action.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a son who was convicted in Wisconsin. We moved him to Iowa under the Interstate Compact, and he's now required to register in both Iowa and Wisconsin on the registry and like every quarter. Is that something that is normal?
Brenda, I have an answer for that. I'm not sure who that was directed to.
Paul, let me take the first stab at it, because I talk a lot about Wisconsin. Wisconsin is the only state that I know that insists that it has jurisdiction over people in terms of their registration, and they send people a $100 assessment even when they're out of state. They even send them that $100 assessment when they're in prison, and they tell the people in the letter that if you don't return this $100 with this form with the $100, we'll prosecute you. I'm not convinced that they have jurisdiction. When you take your vehicle out of Wisconsin, you don't continue to register it and pay the fees there. But that's what they do in Wisconsin, and that's what you're talking about, correct, Judith? You're talking about that $100 that they have to send out. You don't have to go to the registration office in Wisconsin, but you do have to return that form, and you also have to register in Iowa.
They actually report to both states, Wisconsin and Iowa, change of employment.
He reports, though. He doesn't actually go to Wisconsin to
physically
register.
No, he does
register.
Not have to go there, but he has to fill out quarterly forms for both states.
Yes, that's what I was saying. So, yes, Paul, that's been a pet peeve of mine for some time. I'd love to see that litigated. I don't believe they have jurisdiction. Now, there are many states who keep you on the website, but you have no obligation to that state. Wisconsin claims that they have jurisdiction to continue to require you to pay them money and to update your registration with them. So, Paul, do you have any thoughts on that?
No, I mean, to go back to the direct question, no, that's not normal. Larry's right that in my experience, many states will continue to keep you registered, but your direct reporting requirement ends when you leave the state. And then on that state's website, it just says, out of state address or something. But that's actually the first instance I've heard of where a state is requiring you to maintain periodic registration verification, despite the fact that you no longer live there. Most states stop caring once they know that you've moved out of state and you're registered with some other state.
So, Judith, I would love to see that litigated. Perhaps we can talk after the program and see how far we might could take this, because it is something that really that is. As far as I'm concerned, it's not constitutional. I would like to see someone tell them to take it and shove it. And I don't think they would actually issue a warrant because no one.
I've thought of that. I've thought of that.
No,
really.
No one's going to want to issue a warrant. Yeah, no one's going to want to issue a warrant. No rational law enforcement entity would issue a warrant for a person who's registered in another state, because the last thing you'd want would be for them to come back. If there's a chance of them reoffending, you would rather they be reoffending in Iowa than Wisconsin. But yes, let's talk later, Judith, and thank you. Feel free to get back in if you have another question. Okay, thanks. Okay, Ed, you're on NARSL in Action with Paul Dubling and Brenda Jones.
I just had a quick question. It seems that in ex post facto cases, the question of punishment is the controlling factor, and that the courts will only decide in a specific instance whether it's punishment or not. Is 5 lashes of the whip punishment, or 10, or what? Is there any way we can bring a case that would induce or force a court to say when punishment happens? You know, now they just say it's not happening in this case. So I'd like the Supreme Court, if possible, draw a line that says, okay, anything beyond this is punishment. They don't seem to do a good job of that. And that's the end of my question.
Sure. So in one sense, it's generally accepted that the Supreme Court has set forward the test for what is and is not punishment. And that's, you know, the Alaska case, Smith v. Doe from 2003, where they said, you know, it's a two-part inquiry where the first question is, did the legislature intend to punish? And if the legislature intended to punish, then we will say it's not, then the inquiry would be over. If the legislature intended this to be a civil remedy, then we will call it punishment based on a weighing of 5 factors, including whether it has historically been considered punishment, whether the connection of the disability, whether it imposes affirmative restraints and disabilities, the degree of connection between the disability or restraint imposed and the, you know, putative civil purpose, which is usually public safety. That's usually what the state says in cases like this. The problem is that framework is really wonky, and as you're pointing to, I think is a bad one, because there's no clear distinction. Like, one, what does it mean to punish someone is not really clearly defined. Two, basically that ends up leaving what you see is any given restriction subject to this balancing test that can really come out any way that you want. And three, just sort of, it doesn't end up with common sense sort of answers, much less a sort of clear line in the sand. It's an area of law where the individual judge ends up basically deciding the case because, you know, it's an amorphous 5-prong balancing test. So what's the answer? No one really knows. You know, so you get, you know, Doe v. Snyder, the Sixth Circuit said, this is clearly punishment. And then you get some cases in other circuits in the 8th and the 10th where you'd say, well, that certainly seems punitive, but they say that it's not. I think in one sense, you know, challenging the basic way in which the Supreme Court analyzes the ex post facto clause is possible, but is a years-long project, because at this point, any lower court is just gonna follow Smith v. Doe. They're just, that framework was laid down 20 years ago. It is, in my opinion, a bad framework precisely because it doesn't generate consistent or principled outcomes. It generates idiosyncratic outcomes. And its reliance on the idea that something is punishment, if it's sort of historically been thought of as punishment, doesn't make sense when you're faced with what are essentially new laws, right? And registry laws have existed since the 1930s. California's is from the 40s. But the modern registry law, the things that we're seeing where there's limits, you know, internet publication, limits on where you can live, where you can be, what jobs you can have, internet use, that go on and on long after any period of supervised release for the actual crime, that's new. You know, public notification registry laws really became a thing, as almost everyone on this call knows, in the mid-90s. But the modern registry law that comes with all these restraints on living, working, internet being, those really come about in 2006, largely, the mid-2000s. And, you know, so you see a lot of opinions that sort of say, well, you know, this doesn't look like colonial whipping or being in prison, so we're going to say it's not punishment. But that's only because this is sort of a new way to punish people, if that makes sense. So I don't like it. I think the framework's bad. But at this moment, it would take a Supreme Court case to change that. And it's a little bit of a catch-22, because since these decisions are idiosyncratic, the Supreme Court is unlikely to take an ex post facto challenge unless it expressly wanted to overturn the ruling of some lower court, or unless it wanted to revisit the framework under which it decides this. And I haven't seen any evidence that there's an appetite for that at the Supreme Court at this time.
So,
may I add a little something, Larry?
Yes, you may. You're the executive director.
Hey, I promise it will not be heavily legal because I ain't. But I did pick up on a certain piece of that question that I think might illuminate a little bit what Paul was just saying. I'm going to see if I can say it in my non-legalese, which is, why don't we get the Supreme Court to clarify the definition? And all of Paul's answer was directed at that, but oftentimes people get confused and they forget that the way the Supreme Court clarifies is by taking a case. You know, we can't just walk into their hallowed halls and say, hey, Supreme Court, would you settle this situation for me? There are, you know, lower court rules, but there's sometimes state court rulings, and then there's circuit court rulings, and then, and so forth. And only if something moves from that bottom level up to the top, and then the court decides there's something they've got to figure out, that's the only way that court is going to change anything. So all of that is just to summarize it down into my idiot level of, why the Supreme Court hasn't done that, and hopefully clarifies what Paul was going at. He's not seeing that happening anytime soon because we aren't seeing cases move up in that way. So I just wanted to toss that in there. Yeah.
I'd like to add one more thing, and that's that a lot of the cases are not properly developed below that go up on appeal. And the burden is always on the challenging party. And the standard is by the clearest of proof, because the presumption is constitutionality. Every legislative enactment is presumed constitutional. And therefore, there's too many of these cases, this may alienate some people, but too many of these cases are decided as a summary judgment. And there's not an adequate factual basis for them, if they're even so inclined, when they're looking at the record, because if you didn't show these punishments, if you didn't demonstrate this with testimony and with evidence, then they can't invent evidence. They don't take evidence at the Supreme Court. So therefore, a lot of this is lack of factual development below. They come up with a conclusion that it's not punitive because we didn't do a good job challenging and showing with evidence and testimony and experts how debilitating these things are. Saying it is one thing, proving it's another. We are starting to draw toward the close of this hour. I'm going to try to get through at least one or maybe two more calls. It's *6 if you want to get into the queue, and I'm going to try to move on. There's like a half dozen in the queue, so I'm going to try to clean out a couple of them before we go to break, at least one. So you're on Narsil in Action with Paul Dubling and Brenda Jones. Go ahead, please. Well, all right. We will move on to the next. Robert, you're on Narsil in Action with Paul Dubling and Brenda Jones.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Several short questions. Is Narsil primarily a litigation organization, or are they looking to change the laws in a broader perspective? In other words, what I see is trying to move state by state, court by court, policy by policy will take 50 years plus. I don't see it. I don't know. Is there more that can be done? And let me just give you two examples. One would be, it seems like there's a lot of power in, there's 8 or 9 really strong organizations in the country that are fighting the registry. If they were to join forces and bring their voter base, perhaps they would have a stronger voice to bring about some type of change. And the second thing is, similar question, is there a national strategy that Narsil has written or endorsed? Or are we looking, again, to go piecemeal, court by court, or do we have a big picture of how do we actually bring about a downfall of this horrendous, draconian situation?
That's a great question, and we're going to be moving to break here. We're going to do that on the flip side, so stay tuned, Robert. We'll get back to that question. We're going to take the 5 minutes now. So I expect my music to start playing any moment, my lovely, lovely music of the transition. but we will come back after a 5-minute break, and we will go to the second hour, and we'll take that question about a national strategy, because that is a very common question, some variation of that, and so we can talk about what that means. So welcome back, everyone, to the second hour of NARSL in Action. We're going to be resuming for another full hour of excitement with our two guests, Paul Dubling and Brenda Jones. Again, we have the contest. This is the last time I'm going to give the number, so one or maybe two more people can text their number to 747-227-4477. I'm going to start answering the previous question, which was a national strategy, and then we're going to have Brenda talk about the upcoming national conference, and then the rest of the program is going to be questions from the audience. So in terms of a national strategy, the problem that is a very good and common question, but the registry is not the same around the country. There are states where a constitutional challenge would be futile. If you were in some of the states where they have something that's not much more than a civil regulatory scheme, where you have to mail in a form every year, and there's limited internet publication, challenging that registry would go nowhere. And each state is evaluated on its registry. So each law, we have 50 separate sovereigns in this country, and each registry would have to be challenged. Now, if there were to be a case that were to make it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court were to reverse their previous position from 2003 and Doe's Smith versus Doe, then that would still not mean that the registry would end in all those states and in all the United States. It would mean that the registry, that there would be a Supreme Court case that you could cite to that might help you challenge your registry, but there is no Supreme Court decision that's going to end the registry. Now I've alienated all of our listeners, Paul. You can go ahead and expand on that answer before we move on to Brenda. Did we lose Paul? We have lost Paul. Brenda, do we have you? Yeah. So, well, Paul has left the premises, apparently. But anyway, as I was saying, that the registry, there's no the registry. There's no federal registry. There's 50 state registries plus the territories. And some registries are very benign. Now, if you don't live in a state like that, or if you even live in one of the states, it's very benign. To you, it's all relative. You think the registry, those that live in Vermont that have to mail in a form, they don't know that you have to do all the things you have to do in Louisiana and Mississippi and all the states that have really tough requirements, proximity restrictions and stuff that they don't even think about. So as far as they're concerned, merely having to mail the form in once a year is debilitating. But,
you know, it's of course a challenge wherever you're publicly listed. But yeah, I was going to mention, in terms of strategy, at least NARSL, that is our strategy, is to continue to try to build case law at the state level, because the more wins we can garner on the more different areas, whether it's ex post facto, whether it's First Amendment, due process, whatever challenges we can find in all of those different states, all of that adds up. And eventually, again, in my non-legalese, eventually what happens there is that there just becomes an overwhelming number of challenges and wins. You know, that's our hope anyway, to where the national government can take notice. And we do also, we don't focus entirely on litigation. It's always a three-pronged effort. The litigation, of course, is one part of that. That's the big stick, you might say. And then we also have, we also attempt to fight these laws in the state, in each state, to at least prevent new ones from being introduced, because they just love adding on the punishment. And occasionally we even have the opportunity to help make things a little better in one state or another, depending on who we have on the ground and what's moving forward there. So we do have that legislative end of things. And the more people that get involved in that grassroots effort, the more we can accomplish there. And then we also have basically an educational component, which is simply getting the word out to people about the truth about persons who are required to register, about the laws that they're subjected to, and so on. And there's even a little bit of an element of support that we've got going. So, yeah, NARSL is not totally litigation. This call has been and will continue to be primarily about litigation, but NARSOL itself is not. And we do try to work with our sister organizations where we can, where we can move something forward more effectively.
In fact, I just announced the presence of the executive director of another organization. I think she's dropped off the call, but we were planning on adding her in here. So Paul has just returned about 5 minutes ago. I guess his call dropped, but Paul is back. So did you want to expand on what Brenda and I were saying, and then we're going to move on to the to description of the upcoming conference. So did you have anything that you want to add, Paul? I've got you back, and I know you're here.
Okay. So, no, more just to reiterate, you know, my field is litigation, and litigation can be splashy, and frankly, it's satisfying when you win litigation because it's public, it's a clear win, you know, it's a clear advancement of the ball. But in terms of a broader strategy, as I've said several times at the NARSOL conference and in other forums, you know, litigation, its ultimate effect is that it creates an opportunity for legislative change. You know, when a law is struck down, the legislature has to decide what to do with that fact. And, you know, in the absence of a coherent sort of voice in the legislature and lobbying effort, sometimes what happens is they just tweak it a little bit and reinstitute it. So the legal victory can be, in practical terms, relatively short-lived. So a legal strategy in terms of advancing public policy goals is just part of an overall strategy. And, you know, I continue to believe that the role of the legal arm is to place checks on what the legislature can do to attempt to change the laws in positive ways. But ultimately, both of those things are in support of the education and lobbying effort, the attempt to get laws not only struck down, but to keep them out of the books. And to the extent that laws can't be brought down, to influence the way laws are crafted and interpreted in ways that make sense. And I think the advantage that NARSOL has, the disadvantage is clear. We're talking about sex offenses, which are a hot button issue with limited political appetite at most state legislatures. But the advantage NARSOL has is the facts are on our side. We can argue to some extent about the recidivism rate. It's low, but we can argue whether it's 5% or 7% or 8% or what have you. But it is at this point sort of beyond cavil that registry laws do not work. If the goal of a registry is public safety, you know, defined as a decrease in the incidence of sexual assaults or offenses in the population, registry laws do not work. Public notification doesn't work, restrictions on where you can live, et cetera. And so we have, to be trite about it, truth on our side. If we can get people paying attention to reality, then reality is these laws are just a bad idea. They inflict immense suffering on the people subject to them with no benefit to the larger public. And that's really sort of the overarching fact that I would like to see, and I hope that we are pushing at the legislative level in terms of furthering the ultimate public of.
We appear to have had Mr. Dubling drop out again. So, yeah, that's all right. We're at the point of the program. We were going to switch gears anyway. We've got people in the queue, and you can continue to wait in the queue. I'm not going to clear it. There are four people. And star 6 will get you in the queue, and we're going to go back to questions. But we're going to spend 5-6 minutes here talking about NARSOL's national conference. And hopefully we can at least attract some people here to be interested in the conference. So, Brenda, is there going to be a live stream option for this conference for people who have COVID fears or just it's too late, but they didn't know about the conference? Are we going to be streaming it? And if so, tell us about how that works.
Oh, yeah, there absolutely will be. We've haven't been promoting it heavily, but at this point, if you go to conference.narsol.org and then click on, you know, I think it's sign up now. If you click on the button to register for the event, you will get to the page where you fill out all your information. When you scroll down, one of the options is webinar. And the webinar is $40 for the whole weekend. So it's quite a steal. It does not cover absolutely everything, but what you will get is everything on the so-called main stage. So all of the plenary speakers, you would be hearing them, and the people who are doing the trainings in that particular space during the training sessions. So you would be getting that particular person people during that chunk of time. So really great opportunity. And I would just stress, if you've been sitting around thinking, well, I'll just wait till it all comes out on a recording. It eventually comes out in a recording. I don't recommend doing that this year. There are two or three of those plenary speakers who are not comfortable having their information, their presentations posted after the event. So you need to get yourself signed up and at least get it that way. You can get it live, and then for a little while you would have access to it behind that same paywall afterwards. So if you're not going to be there in person, I do recommend that you go ahead and sign up so that you can experience the wonder remotely.
And the cost is like $40, I think, right? $40, all right. So,
you know, all day Friday, all day Saturday, and a little chunk of time on Sunday as well.
Let's talk a little bit about, we've got some heavy-hitting speakers that we've been striving, one or two of them, to get for years and years and years. This is conference 13. Do I have that right? Number 13.
I didn't double-check that, but I think you're. I think that's about right.
We've been doing this for years and years and years.
Yeah, quite a while now.
We've had people who were a little hesitant to come speak and be a part of our conferences. This is not something that advances careers. It can be actually detrimental to careers. So we've got some people. So let's try to cover at least the plenary speakers. Why would people want to tune in, or why would people want to attend? I know we're going to have a surge of people showing up in Houston after this phone call. So why would people want to come? What's so exciting about this conference?
Well, okay. Let me just hit very briefly on our keynote speakers. The first person on the docket is going to be Jill Levinson, and she works out of Barry University in Miami. She's an internationally recognized expert, and she studies the impact and effectiveness of these very social policies. So, she's definitely a heavy hitter in terms of what she has published and the work that she has done, and she's spoken about these issues a lot. This particular message that she's going to be talking about is messaging and framing. So she is taking as her topic something that should be educational to us as advocates. How do we frame our messages to get the point across to where other people will listen to us and work in evidence-based suggestions and that sort of thing? So I'm really looking forward to hearing what Jill has to say, and she's the one that's going to be opening us up. The next person on the list will be David Singleton, and he's an attorney and a professor who has been working with OJPC, and I'm going to say it wrong probably if I say what all those letters stand for, but he is a very erudite person, I'll put it that way. He's going to be talking about interest convergence theory and how you can use interest convergence theory to reform sexual offense laws. And he says that began as a theory that helped black people win civil rights victories. And he says that it's gone beyond that now, and he's been using this in his own law practice. And so he's going to be sharing his ideas of how this can assist us, again, in working on behalf of persons who are impacted by the laws. Then, of course, we'll be hearing from our own Paul Dubling, and he's going to be talking about litigation, education, legislation, just what we were talking about a moment ago, those three different areas of effort towards reform, and he'll be discussing how we can take those objectives and use that for effective reform. And you see, I think he gave us a little preview just a minute ago while he was answering that question. And then we're on Saturday now. The Saturday afternoon speaker is Emily Horowitz. And those of you who may have been involved in this for a while are probably familiar with Emily Horowitz's. She was the person who did that debate. And I'm caught off guard because I'm not remembering who she did the debate with, but a lot of people were involved with that, heard the debate, felt like
Marcy Hamilton.
Marcy Hamilton, thank you. I knew you'd remember, Andy. And we use that quote occasionally where she's going, I'm sorry, you're just wrong. She's going, wait. But she's going to be talking about challenging sex offense laws and policies during amplified panics. And many of us have talked about sex panic that's been going on actually for quite some time. So she'll be discussing that and a little bit of the historical background and how to reach these audiences and how our movement fits into that larger historical context. Then the very last folks that we're going to hear from, we'll be hearing our own Mary Sue Molnar. If you're attending, I don't think we're going to be streaming that though. So if you're there in person, you'll hear Mary Sue Molnar speak for a little while during our banquet. And then on Sunday morning, we'll be hearing from Laurie Jo Reynolds from the University of Illinois and the Chicago 400. And this is a campaign that's been led by people experiencing homelessness, and all or most all of the folks in the Chicago 500 are persons on the registry who are dealing with homelessness. And they have been, due to housing banishment, you know, the problems with the housing banishment laws. So they've been doing a lot of work in the legislative and public education arena, and several of them will be coming along with Laurie Jo to share with us on Sunday morning some of how they work and how they organize and message and so on. So I'm real excited to have that tonight going on Sunday morning. So there you are in a nutshell. Those are the all of the plenary speakers that you will be hearing between Friday morning and Sunday morning.
And if someone wins this contest that we're about to have a drawing for tonight, you could use it for the live stream. Now, that would be a diminution of the value of it, because you could turn around and use it in 2022 to actually have a full registration in person, where we would feed you and pamper you and do some things that you won't get on the live stream. But so that is... Well, we're ready. I hope our executive producer is ready to make a selection of all the contestants. How many contestants do we have in there? Is it about 50?
Close to it, actually, for real. It is.
Wow.
So now you're going to use a totally blind pick from the contestant numbers. So how many digits are in the contestant numbers? I didn't ask you pre-show how we're going to do that. So they got a three-digit?
Four digits.
Okay.
Four. I wanted to make sure that we didn't have any collisions as we have in the past of using three digits. So inserted all of the numbers into something like a bingo spinner thing, whatever you want to call it. And I will rotate them, and I will give you a number whenever you say you're ready to go. You ready?
I'm ready to go, and if you're not listening to the program and you need to text Andy when he announces that winner, you need to text him and say, that's me, and he knows, because he's got your contestant number correlated with your phone number. So texting him and not being the contestant will not do you any good. So so select the number, and we will give you a few minutes to text. In the meantime, we'll move on with the program, and then Andy will tell me if we have a winner. He will tell me through our secret ultra secure back channel communications that we have a winner. So
2929. That is the winning numbers. 2929. So send me a message. 747-227-4477. Send me a message from that phone number so that I can know that it is you. You can go from there.
Yes, and we have the finest technology that exists in terms of detecting anybody who's trying to circumvent us. We know everything at Marcel. So, all righty. Paul, he's been back. I've already unmuted him, so he's back. Yeah, well, not only No, he's back, and not only is he back, Adele just popped in, and she did not let me know, but my standing policy is any attorney who wants to be live, I can make them live. So if there are other attorneys that I've missed, but I'm going to unmute Adele, and if you would like to say anything and jump in on answers to these questions we're about to go to. So Adele, you have been unmuted, and I don't have your bio in front of me, but I can tell you that that Adele and Mr. Weinberg, what's his first name? Is it Mark? Mark, right?
Yeah.
You do a lot of litigation in Illinois, and you've gone to Wisconsin, and where else have you been? But you've been doing litigation. You're on the Alliance for Constitutional Sexual Offense Laws. You're on the board of directors there, and you've been on our program way back when we used to do these regularly. So you're welcome to chime in on these people when they're posing these questions.
All right. If I have anything good to say, I will.
All right. So Star 6 will get you back into the queue if you've dropped out. And we're going to go back to phone calls because we've only got about a half hour remaining in the program, a little over a half hour. So I want to take as many as we can. So, okay, so this is going to be from area code 602. You are now live on Arsenal in Action with Paul Dubling and Brenda Jones, and now Adele Nicholas.
Hello, Paul, Adele, Larry, Brenda. Thank you so much for having me on. Thank you for all the work that you do. I would like to know, since the registry doesn't seem to be a single entity that can be taken on all at once, if something like personal privacy legislation at the federal level could include that a person's right to privacy is greater than the public's right to know all of this personal information about a person, even if they've already paid their debt to society. And also, if you think there is a legitimate challenge for certain probation restrictions regarding internet usage, if there's First Amendment grounds, and if there are, is that something that is in your sights, or how high of a priority is that for you? Thank you for taking my question.
Paul, go first, and then Adele, you're welcome. Truly, you are. I'm glad to have you here. So, Paul, go ahead.
And I'm having a little trouble with my connection. Could you repeat that question for me, Larry?
he's still alive. So go ahead and 602, go ahead and frame that up again.
Sure. So do you think that there is personal privacy legislation that could supersede the registry that would basically say that a person's right to privacy is greater than the public's right to know the information that goes out on the registry? And also, do you think there's a pathway for First Amendment grounds regarding internet restrictions that are often imposed by probation?
Okay. So the first one is a little more abstract, but, you know, in general, the idea that the law, the Constitution, sort of embodies a right to privacy is not a theory that's enjoying a historical moment. You know, in many ways, well, in one particular way, the difference between conservative and liberal jurisprudence falls along that fault line. Conservative jurists who clearly are ascendant in the federal judiciary now, I think are unlikely to recognize an unspoken and underlying right to privacy in ways that has not been expressly articulated before. However, if there's a legislatively recognized right to privacy, that certainly creates another avenue to argue. And, you know, one of the, from a litigator's standpoint, one of the attractive things about, you know, sort of the idea of compelled speech, publication of information, is that that sort of thing is subject to a heightened standard of review. It's a First Amendment issue. So, you know, it's difficult to give you a concrete answer without knowing exactly how that played out, but certainly a legislatively recognized right to privacy would create new arguments and new opportunities to bring certain types of challenges, including the publication of information. With regard to your second part of your question, I have much more limited experience dealing with probation restrictions than I do sort of regular laws. It is harder to argue against something that's a condition of supervised release or probation, because largely speaking, as long as something is rationally related to any one of the goals of supervised release, that's going to be upheld. My experience is judges are very, very loath to say that something is outside the bounds of a condition that can be imposed as part of supervised release. So, you know, with the caveat that this is not my area, in the same way perhaps that, you know, the general constitutional bounds of registry laws is my area, I would be more pessimistic about a challenge to a condition of supervised release than I would be about a general challenge under the First Amendment to a registry law, you know, sort of on the premise of compelled speech or publication of information.
Adele, feel free.
Yeah, I can definitely speak a little to that second question regarding probation or parole restrictions on internet access. We're actively working on that issue here in Illinois. We got a favorable decision just yesterday from our judge denying the motion to dismiss a challenge to parole conditions that limit or in some cases ban internet access for persons on parole. There's also an excellent Illinois Supreme Court decision, two decisions now, finding both the parole and probation restrictions on internet access for people with registrable offenses, unconstitutional, citing to Packingham. So I think Paul's point is an important one, that there is greater leeway for lawmakers in imposing conditions on people who are under some kind of active supervision. But I do think this is an area that courts are increasingly sensitive to, given the importance of internet access in the modern age, particularly I guess I'll just say all the things that the court recognized in Packingham that make it really an essential source for all kinds of knowledge and participation in public life. So I'm a little less pessimistic than Paul, perhaps, is regarding those challenges.
Awesome. I feel the same way about the Packingham, although the case did not, well, Paul knows this, but some of the listeners may not, the case was not about a person who was under supervision. That was about a case who people who were no longer under supervision, who paid their debt to society. But these categorical exclusions, they're just imposing them rampantly in my state and many other states, that you can't do this with no unique and narrow tailoring. And you can do almost anything to a person if it's narrowly tailored and specific to their characteristics. But just to say you can't have access to the internet without any justification is really problematic. And I'm glad, Adele, to hear that you guys are still moving forward, and at least they're not kicking you out of court. But I want to see more litigation on that, because I believe that that's a fundamental need, not just a right, but it's a need. You can't function in modern life without access to the internet. So, we're going to move on. Thank you for that question. Star 6 will get you in the queue and in line. And we're going to area code 901, wherever that is. You're on Arsenal in Action with Brenda Jones, Paul Dubling, and Adele Nicholas.
Hey, how y'all doing? I appreciate you, what y'all doing for people that are similarly situated as I. Brenda knows me very well. I volunteered on Awful Boss Up for a while, and I've had connections and, kept up with research and everything. But anyway, my question is, how do we force the courts to comply with a higher court decision? For instance, in my situation, and Brenda knows it very well, is in Doe versus Snyder, it set precedent for, the registry is punishment. So, it violates ipso facto. Well, when I filed filed my first lawsuit, the district attorney, the attorney general, said that the Doe versus Snyder was a Michigan case, and it did not comply or did not, include Tennessee, because Tennessee is a separate state and the registry is completely different. Well, in Doe versus Roush and Doe versus Haslam, the court said that is not true. Doe versus Snyder is precedent for Tennessee, and that the Tennessee registry is the same thing. It, violates ipso facto. It violates the First Amendment, and so on and so forth. I refiled my lawsuit as a writ of mandamus, and for over a year, the state did nothing. They didn't respond. They didn't file a motion for judgment. They didn't file a motion to dismiss. They didn't file, hey, this is our answer. Hey, we need more time. Nothing. For 14 months, they said nothing. And all of a sudden, when I record myself mailing everything and had my witness state, look, we were there when he mailed and emailed and faxed all the documents, the waiver of summons, I mean, the complaint, everything. We were there. And now all of a sudden, they're like, oh, well, for one, the court lacks subject matter jurisdiction because you have to go into the chancery court in the state capital, not in the city that I'm in. And according to the statute that they state, it says that you have to go into you have to sue in the court.
Can we get to a question?
Sure.
We take questions.
But anyway, so how do we, you know, how do we fight the, you know, the subject matter jurisdiction when it says that, yes, I can file inside the court that I'm located in and not in the Capitol building? How can we force, you know, the court to say, yes, you're right, and force the state to comply with Doe versus Snyder and Doe versus Roush and Haslam?
So thank you for that question.
Okay. Adele, if you know anything in particular about the Tennessee procedure, I'd certainly cede to you.
Well, I think I know what Douglas's question is. What he's frustrated about is people see these decisions come out and they know that they're in the circuit and they don't understand why he's wondering, why doesn't Tennessee just go ahead since Doe's versus Snyder is in the Sixth Circuit and clearly Tennessee's registry is bad or is worse. Why didn't they just go ahead and start making changes? That's the essence of his question with the story he's telling. That's what he wants to know.
Respectfully, I think he's got two questions. One is the procedural. Larry, the answer to the question you asked is that it's meaningful. So, you know, Doe versus Snyder took up the specific question of whether the Michigan registry violated the ex post facto law and answered yes. So that decision doesn't mean that the Tennessee registry is per se ex post facto. That's an issue that would have to be litigated. But the decision is meaningful, as the caller alluded to. There were subsequently a couple of cases in Tennessee, Doe v. Roush, and I forget the name of the other one, that, you know, followed Snyder. Because Snyder's in the Sixth Circuit, the way in which the court analyzed it becomes binding and also sent a signal to lower courts in the Sixth Circuit, including Tennessee, that it was amenable to the arguments that these registries were ex post facto. The second question, to finish that up, a Fourth Circuit ruling is only a ruling that applies on its terms to the question and the case before the court. Lower courts, though, look to the Fourth Circuit decisions to basically anticipate how the Fourth Circuit would rule in a separate case but related. And so those decisions have precedential value going forward. But, you know, the fact that Michigan's registry is ex post facto is not dispositive of the fact of the question whether Tennessee's registry is ex post facto. It just sort of strongly suggests that the Sixth Circuit would find it so. And that's why, you know, Tennessee's registry wasn't invalidated by Doe v. Snyder, but Tennessee courts later used Doe v. Snyder to go ahead and rule about Tennessee's statutes. Procedurally, what I understand the caller to be asking is, you know, what I was talking about before, the state typically responds to challenges, particularly ones where there's not a really good defense on the merits of the lawsuit, by saying you sued the wrong people or you sued in the wrong court or this, that, and the other. And different states, particularly with things like writs of mandamus, may have different procedural requirements for sort of how you do something. And, you know, one of the things that I found interesting about becoming a practicing lawyer is often the hardest part of a lawsuit is fighting your way through the mechanics of how do you actually do something, right? How do you actually make an official request to a court for a ruling? How do you get something served to put the other side on a timeline? What do you do when you have properly served one and the other side just doesn't respond? You have to do something. In that case, you have to move for default. If you don't, then it just kind of disappears. So, you know, what I would say to the caller is, you know, if the it sounds like the state has responded by challenging subject matter jurisdiction. That gives you, the caller, an opportunity to respond to the state's arguments about subject matter jurisdiction, and the court will issue a ruling. If your case has merit, it's certainly something I would encourage you to find a lawyer to help you with, to help you cut off what you're experiencing right now, which is the state using procedural games to delay getting it into court. And that's exactly what I was talking about when I was saying that's what I can help people with. That's often one of the biggest challenges, is working through what you're experiencing. I believe, you the litigant, you the caller, saying, look, I know I'm right about this on the law, but I just can't get it into court. And they keep arguing subject matter jurisdiction, or they keep arguing this. They're going to do that. That's a very hard piece of litigation. And it's particularly hard when you're pro se, because that's pretty arcane stuff. And I would encourage you to, try to take that case to a lawyer with some experience, ideally in Tennessee, who would be able to help you do that, help you fight through those procedural issues.
And unfortunately, he's like in many people's position with very limited resources. And hopefully with the Sixth Circuit decision and the cases he mentioned, hopefully he will get some forward progress on his issues. We did not have a contestant win. They are no longer on the call. 2929 did not claim their prize. So Andy has selected another number with the random, very sophisticated computer that we have. So Andy, what is the winning four-digit number?
We will go with 9940. So send me a text message from your phone that goes along with 9940, and you will be awarded a happy, happy prize.
Yes,
and if I could just follow up to the comment you just made, one of the things that I experienced talking to particularly criminal defense attorneys and people who don't have a lot of experience with the civil action is that they're unaware of the ways in which you can monetize valid claims. They often, in cases I look at, there's two or three different ways that you could get a ruling, two or three ways you can get a judgment, but only one of those ways is going to also include an award of attorney's fees, or even if you settle the case, put you in a position where, as part of settlement, you can win attorney's fees, which is very important because it allows people to, without resources, to gain access to good legal counsel when that legal counsel, quite honestly, knows how they can get those fees from the other side, which is its own little trick, if you will. So one of the things I can do, and one of the things I would encourage across the board is, as we sort of build this network and as NARSOL works on these issues, is for people like the caller, I believe in his case, for instance, based on what he's saying, that's a likely valid 1983 suit if styled correctly. I don't know that, of course, I can't get legal advice, but if that case came into my office, the first thing I would look at is, okay, can we do this in a way that we believe it likely that we'll be able to collect attorney's fees? And if so, the lack of personal resources of the litigant ceases to be an issue. So I just want to throw that out there for, attorneys that may be listening or people that are talking to attorneys, challenging registry laws, there are ways to do that generate fees for the lawyers. And I'm aware that a lot of lawyers just don't know how to do that. And so they don't take these cases because they require an immense amount of time, and the lawyer doesn't feel that they can do that with the resources available. But there are ways to do it. So for that caller and for anyone else listening, if you believe you have a valid claim, we can screen that. If it is valid, the fact that you don't personally have resources may not be a barrier to getting competent legal representation to bring your case forward.
I'd perhaps go a bit farther than that, which is I'd be quite skeptical of hiring a lawyer who's going to ask you for money. I mean, we've been doing this work for 6 years and none of our clients have ever paid us a dime. I'd be a little skeptical of a lawyer who is asking for money up front because, as you're saying, if the claim is successful, you should be able to collect fees from the state. And, it's different from criminal defense where the client has to pay up front, because you can't collect a contingency fee or attorney's fees from the state. So, yeah, I agree with what you're saying.
All right. there's a few more people in the queue, and if you want to do a quick question, star 6 will get you in, and I'm going to try to move through these people. So area code 630, you're on Narsil in Action with, God, I forgot the whole list, Paul Dubling, Brenda Jones, and Adele Nicholas.
Yes, this would be a question for probably Paul or Brenda. I just moved from North Carolina to South Carolina, and there is some dim light in the end of the tunnel for lifetime registry to be at least changed to some degree in South Carolina in the near future. I want to give some presentations to make people aware of the situation with the registrants. Where do you get the facts that can back up what we're saying, such as low recidivism rates, some of these laws are draconian? How can we get some facts that can back up what we say to a, like a group of people or a civic club that you want to go speak to, or even to your own legislator?
I could take a first stab at that. You hear me okay? I've been turned off.
Yes.
Yeah. So there are some brochures and a few other things that are available on the narsil.org website, I believe under publications, and you can always just download and print them or request them to be sent if you're wanting to feel especially sleek. There's also a sub-website called resources.narsil.org, and you can look under particular headings. It's not exhaustive yet, but we're adding things all the time. If you're wanting to focus on residency restrictions or reoffense rates or, you know, whatever that particular bit is, and there are a lot of links to past research there. You can go and find one to grab. There is also, if you just need to hunt for a particular state law, a lot of times if you're working with somebody, you're saying it would be so much better if the law were changed, and they would say, what other states are doing it that way? You might need to go research, well, what other states are doing it that way. And our wiki site, which I think you could get to at wiki.narsil.org, but if not, you can go to to narsil.org and look for a link to the wiki there. And the wiki has all 50 states with links directly to their statutes with common questions that get asked. So those are some resources that you can use that Narsil has available.
Great, thanks. And Paul, do you have any South Carolina attorneys that you have gotten friends with or on a relationship with?
Actually, it's interesting that you ask. I just took on a case where an individual who we successfully got deregistered in North Carolina is now looking to be deregistered in South Carolina. South Carolina is one of those states that just sort of keeps you on the registry forever, even though once you leave the state, there aren't any reporting requirements or anything. So I'm vaguely familiar because I just looked at the recent South Carolina Supreme Court ruling saying, look, lifetime registry, just as a matter of course, is not constitutional. There needs to be some sort of hearing. And I'm just in the early stages of figuring out how that works. And while I don't yet, one of the things I need to do in the next couple weeks is look for and try and identify a South Carolina attorney who can help with that effort. What I'd ask you to do is if you will, give Narsil your contact information, I'm happy to pass that on when I do find someone in South Carolina who's interested in working on these issues.
Right. I think the legislature is supposed, they have a year to come up with some way or statute to allow some kind of hearing, whether you can request to be removed or not, or you're a risk or not a risk.
I'll just jump in. So, he was suggesting sending your information legal@narsil.org.
And we have the contact information on the phone anyway. If that phone gets answered, we have it. So nobody answers their phone anymore, but we do have your contact information. So all right, thank you for that one. And we're going to keep moving. Star 6, and The next one is area code 630. Make it very, no, it's not 630. 630 will be next. Robert, you are on Narcelin Action with the whole gang.
Great, thank you very much. Again, I'm trying to learn a lot here, so I have more questions that I can reasonably ask, and I'm not going to ask very many of them. First of all, I really, really appreciated the information on the conference that it could be streamed, because I was concerned about the COVID, and I have been to one that used some software, WHORA. The whole conference of a week was streamed, and it was very effective. So I'll do that, and I appreciate that. The second thing in that area of the conference was that we all, if we're on the registry, we're all going to have to come out of state. We're all going to have to follow the rules. I can leave my state of Virginia, but I have no clue what the rules are to go into the state that the conference is at. I would like to think that there would be a paragraph. You would anticipate that I'm going to have to come to you. I got to get that information. And maybe next year or the year after, if there could be a paragraph that would tell me who to contact or what to do, basically that would be helpful.
In terms of that, when we do that, we try our best to interpret the registration law in every state where we're going to hold a conference. Sometimes there actually is no provision for visitors. It's just practices that have developed because they realize that visitors are present and they think that there should not be there. So law enforcement starts inventing requirements. But in the case of Texas, we have that information on our website that you can be there. As, from the best of the advice we've received is for 5 days, and our conference is only for 3 days. So you'll be fine. And there's no local, there's no restrictions in Houston, nor are there any restrictions in Harris County. But we try to do that. So we make that information available on our conference website.
And I thought I'd look. I'll look again. I appreciate that. I started asking a really long question before, and I just have a half a minute to kind of finish my questioning. The Pam Lynchner Sexual Offense Tracking Identification Act, again, I'm studying now, seems to establish the registry at the national level, the legal parameters. So it's there, although it seems like the states have overridden that, but the national one is in place. Would it be an approach that you could go into, let's see, where is it? If you did some modification to the Walsh Act and the, let's see, I have it written, but I'm not going to find it in time. If the Adam Walsh and the other ones, if you did a hunt and peck, could you not rescind a lot of the portions of the laws that just don't make sense? And that would get us so much closer to something that would be reasonable. Is that possible?
Not sure we're understanding your question. The states have the prerogative to go beyond. Those are the federal Adam Walsh Act is only a recommendation. If you do these things, we will not penalize you by losing your precious federal money. But the states can go far above that, and most have that have achieved substantial compliance, that designation. Most have gone beyond what they would need to do. For example, indecent exposure is not recommended by the feds to be registered. Almost every state registers indecent exposure. The proximity and residence restrictions are nothing in the Adam Walsh Act. There's nothing in the federal regulations implementing the Adam Walsh Act that suggest or even hint about proximity restrictions, but the states have done that. The states are free to do that. We are 50 separate sovereigns, and they can do that. So that, this comes up all the time. People want to know, you cannot pass a law, and we got two lawyers here, but there, you can't pass a law at the national level that says the states can't do something with rare exceptions. The states are free. I think it's the opposite. You know, the powers are not expressly provided to the federal government or reserved to the states. And the states can register as many people as they want to for as long as they want to until the courts tell them that they can't.
So we really can't look to Congress to solving this problem, can we? Well, or at least making a dent in it.
Well, people raise that out all the time. If you were to appeal the Adam Walsh Act tomorrow, we would still have 50 registries that would be operating. They would not go away. They would still be operating as they are today.
Funding, you could take the funding away. I think you've answered my question. I'm just, so, you know, I'll figure out a way that I can just kind of chit-chat for some length of time, but you've answered the question. Thank you.
So thank you so much. We did not have good communication on the prize winner. So code 2929 did not respond. I know why I announced that one, but apparently on the YouTube audience, they were not hearing the second number. So Andy, what was that number again for the second drawing? 2929 did not materialize.
Yeah, 2929 was the first one, but then 9940 is the second number. And you have just a couple minutes, and then we'll pull another number.
Yeah, 9940. And if nobody's present, what we're going to do is we're going to pull one more number, and then we're going to select from the three. We're going to randomize those three. We're going to pick the person and contact them. But the rules are you're supposed to actually be here to win. So 9940. If you don't text in soon, we're going to... All righty. So what is the next number, just in case? Have you rolled that fancy program?
4118 is the third number.
So 4118. If you have that, text right now. And between those three numbers, if none of you are there, we're going to pick one, and that's going to be the winner. So, did they text?
I got it.
They texted?
Yes, I got the 9940.
Oh, you got the 9940. Okay, so all righty. Well, then the four. What was the other number? I'm going to give them a runner-up prize. So go ahead and retain that, and we'll figure out something to give them because we did announce it. So have they responded? If they do respond, we'll give you something as well. So it will be my decision. So, it may be a gift card. So, but we'll give you something as well. Or it may be a live stream that we'll give you a second prize. That's a great thing. You know, the first prize will be for in person, and the second one will be a live stream if the person is it. So how's that? That's on the fly making a decision. So we have come to the end almost of this, and I certainly want to give each of the guests a moment or so to say something before we close out. So, Executive Director, what do you want to close with?
I will just play the hostess and thank everyone so much for coming and listening in for the last 2 hours, and for putting up with all of us and our responses that you may or may not have liked to hear. I am looking forward to seeing some of you next week. Wow, 1 week to go. So I'm looking forward to seeing some of you in Houston. And for those of you who are going to listen into the webinar, you'll spot me every once in a while, probably, on the webinar, and I'll be thinking about you there too. We appreciate everybody and your participation, your contributions, and your continued involvement and support.
And Adele, even though we didn't schedule this, it was an honor to have you. And in fact, we're thinking about reviving this Northland Action more regularly. A year and a half is kind of a long time to go between. So did you have anything you want to close with? You just mentioned your cases, but tell us in a minute, what are your parting words?
Oh, I appreciate your having me on for a little bit. It's always inspiring to hear from other advocates who are working on this challenging area, and just keep the faith.
Thank you, Adele. And like I say, I really appreciate you dropping in. And Paul, who you will be hearing from on the live stream or in Houston as we wrap up, what are your parting words of wisdom?
Just that I would encourage people, if you've got enough interest to be on this call, I would encourage you to come to the conference if you can, and attend virtually if you can't. For anyone out there that didn't get a chance to ask a question or has a more detailed question, I will be at the conference all 3 days. And one of the things I will be able to do there is talk to people more specifically and help them hopefully get their issues resolved, or help them get linked up with people that can help them with their issues. So please come to the conference. And if you do, feel free to flag me down, and hopefully we'll have a chance to talk there.
Well, I did leave a number of people in the queue, and usually I keep going, but in this instance, I have an obligation to go to this evening, so I'm going to sign off. So we're going to end the program, end the call. We appreciate everybody on YouTube and everybody who's actually on the old-fashioned phone. And we'll hopefully see you virtually or in person in Houston starting next Thursday for a meet and greet, and then Friday morning at 9 a.m. for the kickoff of the 13th annual conference. So long, everyone.
So long, everybody.